Blog Talk Radio.
Samu, back then, Jula.
Jamaica, yeah, 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 yeah. America, America, America. Break the neck of this apartheid. America, America, America. Break the neck of this apartheid. Ijande.
Kana cho adaye toira.
Ijande.
Kana ke jugu saboye.
Ijande.
Kana ke yeko flaye.
Ijande.
Ijija. Ijija.
Ijande.
Ijija. Ijija o.
Ijande.
Kana cho adaye toira nere. Okana ke jugu saboye.
Ijijande.
Okana ke yeko flaye.
Ijijande.
Ijija, ijija.
Ijijande.
Ijija, ijija o.
Ijijande.
Yeah.
Come back, Jesus, my
got Stevie Wonder. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And that was the music.
Overwhelming support at the UN General Assembly for Palestine's bid for full membership. It echoes the rising condemnation of Israel's war on Gaza. But the US says it will veto the motion again at the Security Council. So what difference could the resolution make? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Neve Barker. The international community has debated Palestinian statehood for decades. Full membership at the United Nations would effectively recognize that. Sweeping support at the General Assembly is the first step, but the final seal of approval comes from the UN Security Council. Last month, the United States vetoed a resolution tabled by Algeria and says it will do so again. So can the moral weight of world opinion reflected at the UN General Assembly pressure the US to reconsider? What difference could the backing of 143 nations make to Palestine's non-member special observer status? We'll explore these and other issues with our guests in a moment, but first, this report by Katia López-Soriano.
Condemnation of Israel's war on Gaza has led to protests like these, from Sana'a in Yemen to Jordan's capital, Amman. Rallies in solidarity with Palestinians that first took hold in U.S. universities have spread around the world. And at the United Nations, the General Assembly voted overwhelmingly to grant new rights and privileges to Palestine. It's also calling on the Security Council to reconsider Palestine's bid to become a full UN member.
We want peace. We want freedom. A yes vote is a vote for Palestinian existence. It is not against any state.
Israel says the move is absurd, especially after Hamas's attack on October the 7th. While using a prop, the Israeli ambassador said the resolution disregards UN statutes.
You are shredding the UN Charter with your own hands. Yes, yes, that's what you're doing, shredding the UN Charter. Shame on you.
The UN vote may be widely symbolic, but it comes as countries such as Spain, Ireland, and other EU members plan to formally recognize the state of Palestine on May 21st.
The international community are overwhelmingly saying that they want that long-term resolution to the conflict, and that involves two states.
Despite new rights and privileges, Palestine remains a non-member observer state at the UN without the right to vote. And the U.S. has made it clear it will use its veto power to block Palestinian membership and statehood until important issues are resolved with Israel. Katia López-Odoyan, Al Jazeera, for Inside Story.
Right, well, let's bring in our guest now. From Rome, we're joined by Jeffrey Sachs. He's a former special advisor to the UN Secretary General, now the director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. In Ramallah, Mustafa Barghouti is the General Secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative. And in London is Yossi Meckelberg, an associate fellow at the Middle East and North Africa program at the UK think tank Chatham House. A very warm welcome to all three of you. Welcome to Inside Story. Yossi, I wonder if I can start with you, if you could help us set the scene, because until now, Palestine has only held the status of an observer at the UN. What does the overwhelming passing of this new resolution, what does that mean in terms of the rights and privileges afforded to Palestine now?
In principle, it hasn't changed much because it's the Security Council that such a resolution will actually bestow a recognition as a state. But I think symbolically, it is a very important step forward, in which you have more than 140 states actually very clearly declared that they want to see Palestine recognized as a state. And at the same time, it's known to everyone that the only country that blocks Palestinian statehood from being internationally recognized is the United States. While the United States is moving slowly in different direction when it comes to its relations with the United States, I think moving towards that, and probably if this is the direction, we might see the United States also at one point or another, hopefully soon, follow what the General Assembly just said yesterday and recognize Palestinian statehood.
Jeffrey, following on from that, amongst some of the rights and privileges now afforded the Palestinians is the right to be seated among member states alphabetically.
An ability also to submit proposals and amendments directly without having to do it through another country. As Yossi says, though, these only seem to be a slight move forward when it comes to what the Palestinian state is really looking forward to. Is this largely symbolic, then?
Well, it's important. It's more than symbolic. It demonstrates where world opinion is overwhelmingly. And it is correct. The United States is the sole obstacle, actually, not only to Palestine's membership in the United Nations as the 194th member, but actually the United States is the sole obstacle, in my view, to peace in the region. Because with the membership, with sovereignty, with the implementation of a globally recognized state on the 1967 borders with capital in East Jerusalem and control over the Islamic holy sites, there would also be the ability to have peace with the countries of the region, as in the Arab Peace Initiative and in the Arab and Islamic leadership statement in Riyadh last November. So the United States is not only blocking a Palestinian state, it's blocking peace. It's blocking peace on behalf of a radical, extremist, violent Israeli government, which is committing massive war crimes, and quite likely the ICJ will rule genocide. This is what the United States is enabling right now. It's absolutely distressing for me as an American to see this. Young people on my campus were aghast at what this administration is doing.
I sense early on in this conversation an eagerness by the two of you who have spoken so far to focus on the obstacles that are clearly in the way when it comes to Palestine's full membership. But before we go into the obstacles, Mustafa, turning to you, if this decision at the UN means anything, it's where you are, your reaction to what played out at the UN.
Well, it means a lot. Besides the symbolic aspect of it, it sends a message, a very powerful political message, that the world is for the rights of Palestinians to be free from occupation, from the system of apartheid, from this terrible genocide that is happening. And while we are talking, by the way, the Israelis are committing terrible massacres at this very moment in Rafah and inside Gaza City, in Al-Zaytun neighborhood and in Jabalia, trying to ethnically cleanse one more time Jabalia area. So, of course, the whole world is sending a very powerful message here that they don't accept what's happening to Palestinians. But more than that, I think this vote that took place exposed how isolated the United States and Israel are. You have to remember that the United States of America, this huge power, and Israel could not mobilize more than three countries to vote with them, considering that the others are Palau, Micronesia, Marshall Islands, and Israel and the United States itself. I mean, with all due respect, these little islands don't really, I mean, we all know that they vote according to what Americans tell them. So in reality, this is a huge isolation of the American position.
Right.
One moment, please. And also it shows how isolated the fact that the United States have obstructed the membership in the United Nations Security Council. It is totally unacceptable, and the world is saying that.
Right, absolutely. We will delve, no doubt, into U.S. Obstruction, as you say. I wonder, though, practically speaking, Mustafa, given what has played out of the U.N., whether practically this makes any difference to the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza and Palestinians in the occupied West Bank.
Not a lot, and not enough for sure. It's very little if you compare it to what needs to be done. Netanyahu's behavior in undermining what was a possible agreement for a ceasefire, when Hamas accepted what was proposed to them by the United States, Egypt, and Qatar after they were told that Israel accepts it. And once Hamas accepted it, Israel undermined it. And Netanyahu initiated his Rafah operation, which will not be limited to the eastern side of Rafah. Not at all. He already expanded it into other areas, and I'm sure he will not stop till he finishes the total destruction of Rafah, which means destruction of all of Gaza Strip. The only thing that will stop Netanyahu is sanctions immediately. There has to be military sanctions. There has to be economic sanctions. There has to be real actions by all these governments that kept telling us for the last 2 months that they are against an operation right. in Rafah, and they're doing nothing when he is committing this terrible massacre. I'm talking about Europeans. I'm talking about the United States of America. I'm talking about even the Arab countries. This has to be stopped, and it can be stopped only with immediate sanctions on Israel.
Right, right. Let me bring in Yossi, because clearly, as we've heard there from Mustafa, practically on its own, this enhanced state at the UN, this enhanced status for Palestine at the UN, won't on its own make much of a difference at all without a multi-pronged approach. Sanctions is something, of course, that Mustafa reiterated there. But does this, though, at least pave the way for full membership at some time in the not-too-distant future, Yossi?
I think, first of all, you know, when I say symbolic, symbolism in diplomacy is important. And I think it sends a clear message what the world thinks. I think, again, we are edging closer to recognition. For all means and practices, a Palestinian state exists in one shape or form. It's about the recognition itself. There is leadership. All in all, we know the territory of what is a future Palestinian state. So this is there. It's about how it recognizes and how it changes the relations between around the negotiation table when it eventually comes between the Israelis and Palestinians. Now, but at the same time, the most important thing right now is to stop the war, because this is not going to change what the people of Rafah and the people of Gaza are enduring right now. This doesn't stop settler violence. This doesn't bring us much closer into ending this conflict. That's where the concentration should be. Oh. So the recognition Palestine of a state is important as part of a much bigger move towards the peace process and a peace deal.
I know by listening to you that you're all very, very keen to talk about the obstacles in the way of Palestine becoming a full member of the UN. Now, turning to you, Jeffrey, the main stumbling block, as we've said, remains at the UN Security Council, where, just to remind our viewers, at least 9 affirmative votes and no veto from any of the 5 permanent members is required. The problem, as we've all said, is that at the moment, a key member, the United States, repeatedly votes against recognizing the Palestinians as a independent state, claiming it would be, quote, harmful for peace. Jeffrey, can you explain what they mean by harmful for peace, the rationale behind this?
U.S. That's politics right. is dominated by the Israel lobby. It's very simple. Washington political class has sided with Israel no matter what Israel has done, up to and including genocide. It's not complicated, but the American public is against this. The young people are shocked, dismayed, and out on the campuses across the country. And then Congress and the administrators of these universities bring in the police to bash their heads and to call in the police. So this is extremely unpopular in the United States, but this is a political class that is really led by the Israel lobby. I think what is important is the whole world make clear to the United States, you alone are blocking peace. Now, this is what Palestinian ambassador said yesterday at the UN in a very powerful speech, Ambassador Riyad Mansour, in a very eloquent and powerful speech. The Israeli ambassador, Erhad gave the single worst and most disgraceful speech that I recall in listening to hundreds of speeches in the UN General Assembly during the past 25 years of my work with the UN. Absolutely a speech of hate and a speech of war. But he was counting on a political class in Washington that will stand by Israel. It won't stand by Israel for long under this, because the American public opinion is absolutely against this, and for absolutely good reason.
Let's turn to Mustafa again, because the U.S. has also claimed that the recognition of Palestinian statehood would, quote, undermine efforts to resume negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, essentially rewarding the Palestinians for whipping up international pressure on Israel and effectively rewarding the armed wing of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other armed groups for carrying out violence. What do you make of this argument by the United States, Mustafa?
It's the mother of all hypocrisies. It's such an amount of hypocrisy when the United States and some European countries keep talking about a two-state solution and advocate for two-state solution, and at the same time do not even recognize Palestine. And not only that, they do not say that Israel must end its occupation of Palestinian territories. If Israel does not end its occupation, how can we have a state? Where will we have it? In the diaspora? And third, they are not saying that Israel must dismantle all settlements that exist now in the West Bank without and Jerusalem. Without that, we will not have a Palestinian state. So what you see here is a huge amount of hypocrisy by these countries, that all they do by talking about two-state solution, all they mean is to give Israel more time to continue the process of settlement building and annexation of the West Bank and killing the very possibility of a Palestinian state. Look at what's happening. There are talks. There is this resolution in the United Nations, which is just paper. But in reality, on the ground, what is Netanyahu doing? He's closing off, destroying any final contact between any Palestinian land and any other Arab country by taking over Rafah and the Rafah crossing with Egypt. This is one of the destructive acts that is aiming at killing the possibility of a two-state solution. So this American position and some European positions are nothing but hypocrisy. They are hypocritical when they speak only about a two-state without recognizing the Palestinian state. And one more thing, I think when the whole world saw how the Israeli delegates arrogantly shredded the Charter of the United Nations in front of everybody of the General Assembly, what does that mean? He's sending a message that Israel is above the law and above international law and impunitive to international law, and that could not have happened except without the American full support to Israel.
Yossi, turning to you, Mustafa is very, very adamant. Mustafa is very, very adamant there. There's a huge amount of hypocrisy. There's absolutely no incentive whatsoever for Israel to ever recognize a Palestinian state while it goes about accelerating its settlement building in the occupied West Bank. Of course, both Jeffrey and Mustafa have referred to that semi-theatrical moment at the UN in which Gilad Erdan, the Israeli ambassador to the UN, shredded the UN charter, accusing the UN of appeasing so-called terrorist-laden Palestinian politicians or the authority who want to kill all Israelis and Jews. Is the passing, Yossi, is the passing of this resolution in any way a violation of the UN charter, as Israel argues?
Obviously it's not, and unfortunately Ambassador Erdan is dealing more and is an inclination more to the theater and the drama of the UN instead of substance. It is actually the role of the United Nations to decide about recognition of other states. So, no, and all this kind of theater of shredding the charter, I don't think he covers himself with glory and not the country he represents. This is highly regrettable.
Right.
I also don't take the oversimplistic view that if only change the Israeli government, we remove all the obstacles for peace. There are other elements outside Israel that are obstacles for peace. But Israel needs a change of government. Israel needs a change of direction. And without it, yes, I agree. There is also in the United States an element of hypocrisy. If the United States believes in a two-state solution, let's move on from recognition of statehood as a condition part of the negotiation, but put this first and then put both Israel and Palestine on equal footing that they can negotiate with one another as states and deal with all the other outstanding issues from Jerusalem as the capital of both and
right.
refugees and borders and settlements and the rest as two states dealing with each other with responsibility and with respect. And that's what we haven't seen, and that's what must
right.
change.
So if there are going to be future negotiations, they must be on a level playing field with respect and responsibility on both sides of the equation. Jeffrey, turning to you again, because I also want to look at one of the other apparent obstacles for Palestine being a full member of the UN. It comes from concerns about setting a precedent for other observer countries that are aspiring to full membership at the UN. I'm thinking of Kosovo and its tensions with Serbia, Taiwan, its tensions with China. Will offering full membership to Palestine complicate similar parallel situations elsewhere in the world? Kosovo, Taiwan?
No. This has been the will of the international community and core to international law for at least 57 years since the 1967 war. The notion that there need to be two states, of course, goes back even two decades before that. This is a long and specific history. There needs to be political self-determination for Palestine and a state of Palestine as a UN member state. This is not in any way a dangerous precedent. This is quite the contrary. This is a protection of the basic political rights that have been recognized for decades. Why the U.S. position is not only deeply hypocritical, it's profoundly cynical, because what it says is, well, let the parties decide that, knowing that Israel says no. So it has given a veto to the state of having a state of Palestine to Israel, to the occupier. This is an absurdity, but this is the U.S. position. We don't want to decide on a state of Palestine because Israel needs to negotiate that. Are you kidding? The occupying power, the government that says greater Israel, we control everything, that's the one that has the veto over Palestinian self-determination. That's the actual U.S. position. I don't know how much is cynical, how much is bought off, and how much they're fools, but they have been blocking peace for decades. That's the U.S., I mean.
All three of you have been very vehement in unraveling the obstacles in the way when it comes to Palestine's full membership of the UN. I wonder if we can look ahead to what full membership would mean if and when it happens. Mustafa, Israel was granted full membership of the UN 75 years ago. Today, Palestine is still, as we all know, very much waiting. What would it mean to be negotiating with Israel, as we've mentioned before, on this level playing field, state to state?
Well, let me remind you that when Israel was recognized by the UN, there were two conditions that Israel had to fulfill, and they never fulfilled it, which is the fact that the 181 resolution said that there will be a Palestinian state near Israel. And that never happened. And second, that Israel would implement the 194 resolution, which would allow all Palestinian refugees that were displaced by Israel to come back home. Also, they did not implement that. So practically, Israel undermined its membership by not fulfilling these conditions. That's one. Second, yes, there is a value of recognition of Palestine and accepting it as a full member, because that would mean that every measure of Israeli settlement and every measure of annexation has no political and legal value anymore. It would mean this is a state under occupation. That would be absolutely useful. But I have to say that even when the Palestinians and some Arab countries proposed to the United States a plan for 3 years pass towards the state through negotiations with Israel, etc., United States refused to accept the plan. Blinken refused to accept it and said you have to negotiate everything with Israel. Why Israel took a resolution in their parliament with 99 members out of 110 Jewish members
Mustafa, I'm keenly aware that we're approaching the end of the program, and I want to focus now on what a Palestinian state would look like. So as a follow-up to you, Mustafa, and of course, what it would look like maybe in an entirely separate show. But given the huge disillusionment with the status quo there, particularly in the occupied West Bank, the failure to hold elections, in close to almost two decades now, how ready is Palestine for statehood?
Oh, Palestine has been ready for a long time. Look, we've built many states in the Gulf. We've built many states in other countries. We are so equipped academically, we are equipped scientifically with resources, with people who are so capable. It's the occupation that is preventing us. And more than that, Israel is transforming into a fascist structure. This government is fascist by all means. And that's the obstacle. It's not the lack of readiness on the side of the Palestinians or the need for reform, as they claim. The problem is occupation, right, the system of apartheid, the fascism that is growing. And that will not be stopped without sanctions, without boycott, without effective policy that says to Israel, enough is enough. And for the sake of Palestinians and Israelis, peace has to come. And it cannot come without the freedom of the Palestinian people.
As you say, peace cannot come without the freedom of the Palestinian people. It has been a fascinating discussion, a very, very interesting journey with all three of you. Jeffrey Sachs, Mustafa Barghouti, Yossi Mecklenburg, thank you very much for joining us on Inside Story. And thank you, too, for watching. And you can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on X. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From Edie Barker and the whole team here, bye for now.
Welcome back. And that was...
Make sure to subscribe to our channel to get the latest news from Al Jazeera.
That was a report on the United Nations General Assembly vote just this last past Friday to accept Palestine as a state within the international community. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, May 12th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Some of the lead stories in today's Pan-African Newswire deals with the situation in Uganda. Barbara Nabulu was one of three girls in her family, but when her sister died, her mother wailed at the funeral that she was left with just one and a half daughters. The half was the ailing Nabulu, who at age 12 grasped her mother's meaning. Quote, "I hated myself so much," Nabulu said recently, recalling the words that preceded a period of sickness that left her hospitalized and feeding through a tube. The scene underscores the lifelong challenges for some people with sickle cell disease in rural Uganda, where it remains poorly understood. Even Nabulu, despite her knowledge of how the disease weakens the body, spoke repeatedly of the, quote, "the germ I was born with," unquote. Sickle cell disease is a group of inherited disorders in which red blood cells, normally round, become hard, crescent-shaped. This mishapen cell clogs the flow of blood, which can lead to infections, excruciating pain, organ damage, and other complications. The disease, which can stunt physical growth, is more common in malaria-prone regions, notably Africa and India, because carrying the sickle cell trait help protect against severe malaria. Global estimates of how many people have the disease vary, but some researchers put the number between 6 and 8 million, with more than 5 million living in sub-Saharan Africa. In other news, in regard to the situation in neighboring Kenya, Winnie Makinda, 35, says she is facing the worst crisis and lowest moment in her life because of the Kenyan government's response to floods that devastated her poor community in the capital of Nairobi. The floods and mudslides swept away people and inundated homes, killing at least 267 people and impacting more than 380,000, according to government statistics. The floods are fueled by unusually heavy rainfalls during Kenya's rainy season, which starts in March and sometimes extends to the month of June. Hardest hit are people living close to rivers, including the Matai River running through Nairobi. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. South Africa urged the United Nations top court on Friday to issue more emergency measures to restrain Israel, saying its military incursion in Rafah threatens, quote, the very survival of Palestinians in Gaza, end quote. The request marks the fourth for additional measures by South Africa, which filed a genocide case against Israel late last year at the International Court of Justice. According to the latest request, the previous preliminary orders by the Hague-based court were not sufficient to address, quote, a brutal military attack on the sole remaining refuge for the people of Gaza, unquote. At hearings in January, lawyers for Israel argued that its war in Gaza was a legitimate defense of its people and that it was Hamas's militants who were guilty of genocide. South Africa has asked the court to order Israel's withdrawal from Rafah, to take measures to ensure unimpeded access to UN officials, humanitarian organizations, and journalists to the Gaza Strip, and to report back within 1 week as to how it is meeting these demands. And finally, in the Horn of Africa state of Somalia, the country is asking the United Nations to terminate its political mission in the country, which has been assisting the government to bring peace and stability in the face of attacks by the Al-Qaeda-linked extremist group Al-Shabaab. In a letter to the Security Council and Secretary General Antonio Guterres, he obtained this on Friday by the Associated Press, Somalia Foreign Minister Ahmed Malim Fiki said the decision followed, quote, a thorough consideration of our strategic priorities. The current mandate of the mission, known as UMSOM, expires this coming October 31st, and Fiki asked for the swift conclusion of the necessary procedures, termination of the mission by the end of the mandate. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you would like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website, and that is at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, May 12th, 2024, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And we'd like to, of course, take a break right now, and we'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. The Four Tops, Detroit's own Motown sound, with the 1967 track entitled You Keep Running Away, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for this Sunday, May the 12th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studio in downtown Detroit, and right now we want to move into a report from the Global Anti-Apartheid Conference that is taking place this weekend in the Republic of South Africa. Here is the address delivered by Dr. Naledi Pandor, who is the South African foreign minister, who has been outspoken on the question of solidarity with Palestine.
I hope all of you present here who come from many different countries have written to your foreign ministers to ask them how they voted on the resolution on membership of the United Nations for Palestine. And to also tell them you expect that when that resolution comes to the General Assembly, they will vote yes for membership. Write to your foreign ministers. Find out how they are acting in the halls where it matters. The activism you have committed to by being present here means that you are aware of everything, means that you write on everything, means that you petition on everything. You do not secure victory by sitting in a conference room. You secure victory by action. All of us as humanity should be ashamed today that 35,000 plus people have died, and here we are sitting while more are killed. Maybe if we could find a way, we should all go to Palestine and be the wall of protection of civilian people. There can never be peace if the Palestinian people are not free.
Here's a reminder to please like and share the video and subscribe to our channel to watch more videos on Africa's geopolitics, economy, and changing landscape. We have decided to bring videos on something nobody talks about, African politics, economy, and increasing power. Let's continue now.
The United Nations General Assembly, as well as the UN Security Council, are obliged to heed the compelling evidence presented by Amnesty International, other human rights organizations, as well as the evidence presented in our own case as South Africa at the International Court of Justice. And these multilateral bodies should hold Israel accountable for its crimes against the Palestinian people. The reports from these organizations shine a clear spotlight on Israeli laws and practices that warrant scrutiny and appropriate action. The national laws passed by the Israeli government are clear evidence that the government is set on maintaining Israel as an apartheid state. Since 1948, Palestinians have endured ethnic cleansing, the Nakba of forced displacement and exile, the denial of their right to return, and an ongoing process of domination, foreign occupation, annexation, population transfer, and settler colonialism. I was amazed when a South African political party leader said you cannot, in his view, deem Israel an apartheid state because there was no reflection of apartheid practices in Israel. I wondered where he lives in this world, because all these elements I've spoken to were present under apartheid. We gather here today, just before May 15, the date when we always commemorate Nakba Day, which in history marked the beginning of the never-ending struggle for independence for the Palestinian people and the beginning of the denial of their rights as laid down by international covenants such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. We also meet importantly on the day 30 years ago when President Mandela was inaugurated as the first democratically elected president of South Africa. And I believe when President Mbeki was inaugurated as the first democratically elected deputy president of South Africa. The Nakba involved a combination. Nakba means catastrophe. It involved a combination of mass murder, forced displacement of thousands of Palestinians by Zionist militia to replace them with Jewish immigrants and create what is known today as the State of Israel. We are now witnessing what we have coined as Nakba 2 in Gaza. This conference provides us with an opportunity to demonstrate solidarity with the people of Palestine and to collectively acknowledge the fact that they are still deprived of many rights, including the right to self-determination and the right to independence. The policies and legislation of Israel have been shaped by an overarching objective to maintain a Jewish demographic majority and maximize Jewish-Israeli control over the land to the detriment of Palestinians. We wish to emphasize that as South Africa, this situation has to be brought to a change, and only we, gathered as a collective, can help bring about this change. You all know the directives of the current Israeli government that was formed in December 2022, that it explicitly declared that the Jewish people have an exclusive and unquestionable right to all areas of the land of Israel. And it pledged further to promote and develop settlements in all parts of the land of Israel, in the Galilee, the Negev, the Golan Heights, Judea and Samaria. And the transfer of the administrative powers of the occupation to the Israeli government and the extension of direct civil legal authority over the settlements. This amounts to full de jure annexation of the occupied territories. In recent months, Israeli officials and settler movements have been calling for resettling of northern Gaza and places that the Israeli army has destroyed during its ongoing genocide in the Gaza Strip. We need to stress that there can be no solution to the situation for as long as the international community continues to ignore Israel's systematic human rights transgressions and settler colonial apartheid project, and through it sustains the illegal Israeli colonial settler project at the cost of Palestinian liberation. On the 21st of August in 2022, we in Palestine launched a strategic dialogue with the intention of mobilizing African countries to support Palestine and to enhance bilateral relations with Palestine on the continent. The other objective was to exchange views based on the South African experience that will assist to end Israeli domination in Palestinian territories, as well as to support Palestine in raising international awareness on the plight of their people, particularly the expansion of illegal settlements by Israel. As South Africa, we actively lobbied for the withdrawal of Israel as an observer member of the African Union. And we will continue our efforts towards support for a two-state solution and the right to self-determination. And I must, in talking about the AU battle that we have to wage, I must thank Namibia and Algeria for their support. It was very lonely, but we did it. We will also, as South Africa, continue to support Palestinian efforts for membership of the United Nations and the creation of positive, credible, and lasting international mechanisms to address the Palestinian cause based on international law. I hope all of you present here who come from many different countries have written to your foreign ministers to ask them how they voted on the resolution on membership of the United Nations for Palestine, and to also tell them you expect that when that resolution comes to the General Assembly, they will vote yes for membership. Write to your foreign ministers. Find out how they are acting in the halls where it matters. The activism you have committed to by being present here means that you are aware of everything, means that you write on everything, means that you petition on everything. You do not secure victory by sitting in a conference room. You secure victory by action, and we expect that of you. We support all calls for action against Israel's settler colonial apartheid regime, including calls that third states must take steps toward completely decolonizing Palestine. This has to involve the dismantling of all structures of domination, exploitation, and oppression, and the realization of the rights of Palestinian people, rights of freedom, and democracy that all of us love and enjoy so much. We also would want that they should be able to return to their homes, have their lands once more, and have their properties returned to them. Third states need to recognize and condemn, including through regional and international organizations, Israel's discriminatory laws, policies, and practices, which have cumulatively established and continue to maintain an apartheid regime of systemic racial oppression and domination over the Palestinian people. Member states of the UN General Assembly should adopt a resolution, in our view, to reconstitute the United Nations Special Committee against Apartheid and re-establish the United Nations Center against Apartheid to address Israeli authorities' commission of crimes against humanity against the Palestinian people, and to empower these bodies to proactively pursue the dismantlement of Israel's settler colonial apartheid regime. We would also like to see the Office of the Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court expedite the current investigation into the situation in Palestine, including into war crimes and crimes against humanity, comprising the crimes of apartheid, of population transfer, of appropriation and destruction of property, of pillage of persecution, of willful killing, of murder and torture carried out on the Palestinian territory. As South Africa, we remain committed to ending impunity for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. The situation in Palestine should be prioritized by the ICC in order to deliver justice to the victims of these grave crimes. Our country is among the countries that made presentations from 19th to 26th February this year at the International Court of Justice public hearings, following the request for an advisory opinion in respect of the legal consequences arising from the policies and practices of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem. We made our presentation on the 20th of February this year, and in our presentation we told the court that Israel is responsible for apartheid against Palestinians, and its occupation is inherently and fundamentally illegal, and by implication, it is in violation of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination. It's encouraging for us to know that the majority of countries that are supporting the Palestinian cause hold a position that by transferring parts of its civilian population into the occupied territories, Israel violated Article 49.6 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits occupying powers from deporting or transferring parts of their civilian population into the territory they occupy. It also prohibits the individual or mass forcible transfers, as well as deportations of protected persons from occupied territory. This, of course, reaffirms the International Court's advisory opinion on the West Bank wall. Now that the hearings have concluded, the judges will review all the arguments presented, including 57 written submissions, and will provide an advisory opinion in a few months. There must be, I repeat again, concerted international efforts to bring about a just solution to the question of Palestine. This will provide the Palestinian people with their right to self-determination and independent statehood, and also ultimately contribute to the establishment of peace in the region. There can never be peace if the Palestinian people are not free. So it's imperative for us to revitalize international action and seek avenues for justice. We must intensify the call for international action, with the UN playing a leading role to find a solution premised on a just settlement with just laws that are rights-based. We must, as the international community, seek a solution which facilitates equality and equity for all who have the right to live in the territories of Israel and Palestine. In the absence of these, we will not achieve the objectives we wish. Finally, the South African government will continue to act within the institutions of global governance to protect the rights, including the fundamental right to life, of Palestinians in Gaza, which continue to remain at risk, including from the continuing Israeli military assault, from starvation and disease. And we hope to work to obtain the fair and equal application of international law to all in the interests of our collective humanity. All of us as humanity should be ashamed today that 35,000 plus people have died, and here we are sitting while more are killed. Maybe if we could find a way, we should all go to Palestine and be the wall of protection of civilian people. as the government of South Africa, well, I can't quite hear what you're saying, but as the government of South Africa, as well as, no, you're not helping by shouting me down. It's not useful. As the government of South Africa, as well as the governing party, the African National Congress, we will continue to do everything within our power to preserve the existence of the Palestinian people as a group, to end all acts of apartheid and genocide against the Palestinian people, and to walk with them if they wish toward the realization of their collective right to self-determination. We will continue to do so, following in the steps of our great president and founding president of our democracy, President Nelson Mandela. And we will not rest as we follow his instruction that our freedom will not be complete until the freedom of the people of Palestine is realized. On behalf of President Ramaphosa, I thank you for listening to these remarks, and I wish you success in your deliberations.
Thank you very much, Ma. Thank you. That was profound. Before you sit down, we have a friend from Palestine who represents the Kairos Palestinians. They need to say a word of thank you to you. Just a minute.
Good morning, Your Excellency. Dr. Pandor, representing His Excellency President Ramaphosa. On behalf of the Palestinian people and the free world, I would like to express our great appreciation for South Africa's great and exceptional support to the Palestinian people and to Gaza. We have no better friends in the world today than our South African friends. And to simply say thank you feels inadequate. In Christmas, I challenge the world to look in the mirror and ask, where were you when Gaza was going through a genocide? I know where South Africa was, and I know where your amazing, courageous lawyers were. You embody the term costly solidarity, and we know that the ICJ case did not come without cost. But let us be honest. No one is more deserving and rightly positioned for such a step more than South Africa. During a war that has revealed to the world the hypocrisy and racism of the Western world, you stood with moral integrity and credibility to lead our world and take not just Israel to the trial, but the hypocrisy and racism of the West. You have been through colonialism and apartheid, and you have overcome it. And with your help and support, and with God's help, we will overcome our own colonialism and apartheid. So today, we say to the people and political and faith leaders in South Africa, thank you. Thank you for your leadership. Thank you for your courage and integrity. Thank you for standing for truth. And thank you, of course, to all those all over the world, in the streets, in mosques, in churches, in synagogues, and today in universities, who stand for justice, freedom, and human dignity. Your Excellency, please accept a very symbolic gift, but it's a symbolic act from us as a token of love, unity, and solidarity, the kufiya. And I know that everyone in South Africa seems to be wearing a kufiya, but there is symbolism in what I'm going to do, to take the kufiya from a shoulder of a Palestinian and place it on the shoulder of a South African leader and acknowledge that today you carry our cross with us upon your shoulders.
Do you think more nations should also show courage like South Africa did? Are you proud of South Africa's actions? Why did other nations that speak more of human rights fail to take this basic step? Let us know in the comment section if only African nations have taken the Palestine matter seriously. Do you want to watch more videos like this one? If yes, subscribe to our channel and press the bell icon next to it. We have decided to bring videos on something nobody talks about. African politics, economy, and increasing power. Thanks for watching, and until the next video, stay tuned.
Tell us what you think in the comment section. Like and share the video, and subscribe so that you don't miss any of our African videos. It's the best way to support us.
Welcome back, and that was Dr. Naledi Pandor speaking at the World Anti-Apartheid Conference in Sandton in the Republic of South Africa. She is the South African Minister of Foreign Affairs, has been very outspoken and active in the legal arena and the political arena for the end of the genocide in Gaza, for immediate ceasefire, and for the total liberation of the people of Palestine. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, May the 12th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
I've got dreams to remember. I've got dreams to remember. Honey, I saw you there last night. Another man's arms holding you tight. Nobody knows what I feel inside. All I know, I walked away and cried. I've got dreams to remember. Listen to me.
I've got dreams.
Rock dreams.
Dreams
to remember. I know you said he was just a friend.
Mama.
Otis Redding with the track entitled Dreams to Remember. Let's go back to South Africa with the South African Foreign Minister, Dr. Naledi Pandor, speaking on the situation in Palestine.
The International Criminal Court has jurisdiction over the situation in Palestine, and we have previously called on the Office of the Prosecutor to urgently lead a thorough an impartial investigation into this matter, one that complies with international legal standards to establish the facts and bring those responsible to justice. It is the collective duty of the international community to ensure that atrocities of this nature are duly prosecuted in terms of the Rome Statute and the Geneva Convention. If all of this were happening in Africa, they would have already issued warrants. It took 3 weeks to issue warrants on Putin, 7 months, nothing on Prime Minister Netanyahu and his ministers. Of course, you'd have seen in reports today that the prosecutor of the ICC has received, like me, a letter from congressmen who have indicated that if you dare to issue a warrant, we will deal with you. Same letter I have received. Just imagine if South Africa were to ban the SABC. The whole media world would be on us. But what are they saying today about what Israel has done to Al Jazeera? Israel has made it a crime to express any empathy and support for Palestinians. And you also know that due to a range of very successful protests in the United Kingdom, the government there decided to add a new twist to the definition of terrorism, which meant essentially democratic, peaceful protests now become a terrorist act.
Here's a reminder to please like and share the video and subscribe to our channel to watch more videos on Africa's geopolitics, economy, and changing landscape. We have decided to bring videos on something nobody talks about, African politics, economy, and increasing power. Let's continue now.
Allow me to begin. Before I begin the lecture, I just want to make it clear, as I've tried to do in many settings, that South Africa's relationship with the Palestinian cause and the people of Palestine did not begin on the 8th of October. It's a long-established relationship because the people of Palestine were fully part of the international solidarity campaign against apartheid. Some of you who are young may not know that a strong element of the five key attributes that form the core of the liberation struggle, that one of those important elements was international solidarity. Our leaders, such as Oar Tambo and many others, went all over the world educating about apartheid, educating about racism and discrimination, educating about colonialism of a special type, and saying to the world, you have a moral obligation to support us in our struggle for freedom. We wish you to become part of a global movement against apartheid. And that movement would become the International Anti-Apartheid Movement. And comrades and friends in Palestine that were spoken to at the time, even though they were suffering huge oppression themselves, they said, South Africa, we understand, we will join you in the struggle. Whatever way we can support you, we will. So it's a long established relationship. It doesn't begin on 8th October. nor has it got anything to do with the elections, although I'll be voting ANC, but anyway. It doesn't have anything to do with the elections. It's a long-established relationship that we have, and we have it with many in the world. I've just been in Copenhagen in Denmark, and I had a round table with all the activists who were in the international anti-apartheid movement. I met an 82-year-old who had occupied the consulate of South Africa in Copenhagen in those days in the 1970s. And they stayed there and prevented consular services from being rendered by the apartheid state and made all those officials extremely uncomfortable by occupying that building. And there are legions of such stories. I met artists against apartheid who painted all buildings associated with the apartheid state and marked them as racist for all the world to see. So it's vital that we as South Africans have a full appreciation both of our imprint in terms of developing critical concepts for political activism, but also an appreciation of how the world stood with us. People ask me sometimes, how come South Africa is doing more than other Arab countries? And my answer is, I don't know. Because my experience is once the OAU decided to help us in our fight against apartheid, almost all African countries joined and acted in accordance with the decision of the Organization of African Unity. There were a few, you know, irrelevant little ones who didn't quite follow, but the majority were part of the movement against apartheid. So with us, Africans were solid. And we hope that the Palestinian people will enjoy a similar solidarity. So now let me get to my lecture. Allow me to begin by recognizing the coordinator of this important program of the Memorial Lecture, Professor Salim Bali. He's a really radical person, a revolutionary. And I must say, I feel the fact that he invited me, maybe he thinks I've got a bit of revolutionary in myself too. Professor Bali. And then Professor Camilla Naidu, the Dean of the Faculty of Humanities. And my great comrade and mentor, former Minister Ronnie Castrell. Thank you for that very kind introduction. And yes, it's true. I was going to recognize our Director General, whose birthday it is today. Unfortunately, there's a very important meeting I was supposed to attend, and my only substitute can be the Director General. So I would have asked him to come and present this lecture, but I wanted to be here, so he had to go to that meeting for me. Then I wish to recognize Professor Samia Botme, the Dean of Economics of Bazaite University, and all colleagues from Bazaite University who join us today. I wish to recognize Advocate Diana Butu, our distinguished comrades from Gaza who are with us today, and all our comrades from Palestine who join us, and those from all over the international community who have taken an interest in this important subject. And of course you, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, and I suppose my husband Sharif. So nice to be with you for once. It's a real honor for me to address you today at this, the second Shireen Abu Akleh Memorial Lecture. To my mind, this lecture occurs against a troubling backdrop of evident decline in media freedom, with suggestions of complicity by practitioners that were previously ardent fighters for free media and expression. Just imagine if South Africa were to ban the SABC. The whole media world would be on us. But what are they saying today about what Israel has done to Al Jazeera? It is vital, I believe, that academics and academic institutions devote more time to this decline in freedom of expression and to the growing threat to it. The decline began well before the advent of embedded journalists, but it has lately snowballed, and we need to be very worried about this development. In the past, journalists broadly knew they would enjoy robust and active protection from fearless colleagues and the public who would risk their lives to protect them. I believe the decline we are witnessing today cannot simply be explained away by citing the existence of wireless technology, social media, or other technologies. There's a bigger threat underway, and we need to pay more attention to it. This week, the world marks 2 years since the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh, the beloved veteran journalist who dedicated her life to the pursuit of justice and truth. To date, no one has been held accountable for her death, despite the initial global outrage, and there has been no reported progress in the investigation at the International Criminal Court, and silence with regards to any other investigations. The UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory concluded on reasonable grounds that Israeli forces used lethal force without justification under international human rights law when they shot and killed Shireen in the occupied West Bank, and thus violating her right to life. The situation for journalists in the occupied Palestinian territories has become increasingly grave over the past 7 months. They are marooned and abandoned by their colleagues, even as the world annually celebrates World Press Freedom Day. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, as of April 23rd this year, at least 97 journalists and media workers have been killed in Gaza since 7th October. The targeting of journalists in the occupied territories is part of a pattern of silencing the free press and is an outright contravention of international law. International human rights law obligates an occupying power to allow for freedom of expression and protest. The ability of journalists to cover events as they take place is essential, and efforts to intimidate and assassinate members of the media should not be allowed to continue with impunity. I wonder of us gathered here, how many know the names of the 97 who have been murdered. If Shireen were alive today, she would have been in the trenches in Gaza, reporting day and night on the atrocities taking place, in the hope that the world would take notice and show their solidarity with the Palestinian people. She would have been devastated by the wholesale destruction of civilian life in Gaza and the unfathomable global intolerance of the unending suffering of the Palestinian people, many of whom have died agonizing deaths trapped under the rubble. She would have been reporting on the immense suffering of survivors in Gaza, who are now battling unprecedented hunger and starvation, as well as continuous military assaults by the occupying forces. Regrettably, despite the ruling by the highest court of the United Nations the International Court of Justice. The Israeli state has continued its murderous assault on the people of Gaza with impunity, killing more civilians, maiming thousands of others, continuing the bombing of homes and other buildings and infrastructure, affecting every possible avenue of life of the residents of Gaza. This includes hospitals, ambulances, hundreds of schools, all universities in Gaza, cultural and religious institutions, and much more. The vast majority of the dead and injured are women and children. According to the report by the UN Human Rights Office on 18 April this year, United Nations experts have expressed grave concern over the pattern of attacks on schools, on universities, teachers, and students in the Gaza Strip, raising serious alarm over the systemic destruction of the Palestinian education system. The report states that with more than 80% of schools in Gaza damaged or destroyed, it may be reasonable to ask if there's an intentional effort to comprehensively destroy the Palestinian education system, an action known as scholasticide. The term refers to the systemic obliteration of education through the arrest, detention, or killing of teachers, students, and staff, and the destruction of educational infrastructure, as earlier speakers indicated today. After 6 months of military assault, more than 5,479 students, 261 teachers, 95 university professors have been killed in Gaza, and over 7,819 students and 756 teachers have been injured, with numbers growing every day. At least 60% of educational facilities, including 13 public libraries, have been damaged or destroyed, and at least 625,000 primary and secondary school students and over 100,000 college and university students in Gaza have no access to education. The IDF has damaged or destroyed 9 out of every 10 schools, at least 65 of which were UNRWA-run facilities, sheltering thousands of displaced civilians. Between October 2023 and January this year, the IDF bombed all the universities in Gaza. Consequently, Gaza's treasured intellectual landmarks, including the Islamic University of Gaza, the North Gaza and Tubas branches of Al-Quds University, and Palestine Technical University have all been destroyed. Another 195 heritage sites, 227 mosques, and 3 churches have also been damaged or destroyed, including the Central Archive of Gaza, containing 150 years of history, all gone. Israel University, the last remaining university, was demolished by the military of Israel on January 17 this year. This obliteration of schools, universities, and libraries furthers the settler colonial project of Eurasia, because these are spaces that nurtured the creation and transmission of knowledge. The destruction of schools, universities, libraries, and research facilities has deprived Palestinians of the histories and knowledge housed in these institutions. Attacks on education are often a key indicator of state intolerance of views that do not reflect state thinking. This should not be tolerated by all of us. The international academic community should have sent a clear message that those who target schools and universities in other states will be held responsible, and that accountability for these violations will include an end to collaboration, an end to donations, an end to financial support. Universities are the bedrock of knowledge and truth, and they require freedom to do their essential work of knowledge generation and innovation. World universities must keep a watching brief on the reconstruction of Palestine and insist that the program includes the reconstruction of all education facilities at all levels. And of course, you know that wherever I speak on this question, my expectation is after our talk, you will become activists. I do not talk to passive audiences. Today, as educators, advocates, activists, civil society, and state structures, we should all play a role in the global struggle in search of truth and justice. It is our collective responsibility to raise our voices in solidarity with the people of Palestine, who are fighting for their survival in the midst of the genocidal campaign being waged against them. You may think it doesn't affect you, but one day someone will turn against your university, and that day you will wish you had stood up and acted. Don't let that happen. University students in other regions of the world need to feel the support of universities worldwide in a unified rejection of injustice, harm, and murder. Our own institutions of higher learning have a special responsibility due to the history I referred to earlier, to lead by example and to provide moral and political leadership, given that they claim to play a key role in advancing critical citizenship. How can it be when you say you advance critical citizenship that you are in institutions that are complicit and silent? How is that possible? This has been done by our institutions in the battle against apartheid, and you have to do it again. I remember, you know, days are very nice of protest now. I remember being a lecturer at the University of Cape Town, and they brought Caspers onto our campus. And our students, mainly students of SASCO, I must say, they lay down in front of the Caspers, and those Caspers could not move. They didn't allow them because they said, we are lying down, and if you're going to proceed, you go over our bodies, and you will kill us. They stopped right next to the students. I remember I was right there. But the students were not afraid. They didn't stand up. They stood their ground. They lay there. They stood for humanity. This is all we are asking you to do. In November last year, more than 1,000 individuals connected to higher education in South Africa, including researchers, lecturers, administrators, and students at public universities and other institutions, signed an open letter on solidarity with Palestine. They condemned Israel's onslaught on the people of Gaza and the targeting of schools, universities, hospitals, and emergency support infrastructure. And they called on University South Africa and the Academy of Science of South Africa and their members to do the same. The University of Cape Town and the University of the Western Cape have made official statements calling for a ceasefire and immediate humanitarian aid to Gaza. The UCT Senate has resolved that no UCT academic should collaborate with any academic on any research project if they are identified with the Israeli Defense Force. The majority in the Senate voted in favor of supporting Palestinian academics and the right to have free debates on Zionism without being accused of anti-Semitism. Stellenbosch University Senate members have called for an end to the brutal and barbaric destruction of Gaza, saying that no crimes can justify genocidal actions in retaliation. Unfortunately, the Senate did not pass a resolution on the Israel-Palestine crisis, on the genocide and destruction of scholarship and education in Gaza, as the majority of Senate members did not agree with this resolution. One of the strongest statements has come from the University of Fort Hare, where I will be speaking tomorrow. The university from where many of our struggle stalwarts emanated. The University of Fort Hare has called for an immediate ceasefire that must be enforced by the United Nations and the smooth passage of humanitarian aid into Gaza, equitably distributed throughout the whole territory of the Gaza Strip. The university has expressed its support for our government's call for the International Criminal Court to investigate international war crimes committed by Israel. Of course, you'd have seen in reports today that the prosecutor of the ICC has received, like me, a letter from congressmen who have indicated that if you dare to issue a warrant, we will deal with you. Same letter I have received. Fort Hare has also committed not to pursue any institutional links with Israeli institutions, as these have played a key role in supporting settler colonial oppression and apartheid, and have been complicit in grave violations of human rights, including developing weaponry, military doctrines, and legal justification for the indiscriminate mass targeting of Palestinians. The University of Fort Hare has committed itself to helping end the 17-year siege on Gaza and called for the immediate release of Palestinian academic staff and students who are being held in terms of Israeli apartheid legislation and in violation of international law. We applaud Fort Hare for the strong stand it has taken, and our other universities that continue to express solidarity with Palestinian universities, scholars, and students. But we need Fort Hare to be joined by more powerful forces. And can you imagine if this institution, one of the largest in our country, one of the most significant, one of the wealthiest, one of the most academically productive, can you imagine if it joined Fort Hare, what the impact of such a unity in activism would be? Recently, the renowned Palestinian feminist scholar Nadira Shaoub Kevorkian was suspended from the Hebrew University for her outspoken stance against genocide. Professor Shaoub Kevorkian had previously been unjustly suspended by Hebrew University following a month-long smear campaign by the university, because she urged for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and described Israel's military assault against Palestinians in Gaza as genocide. While she's now been reinstated, Israel has made it a crime to express any empathy and support for Palestinians. And you also know that due to a range of very successful protests in the United Kingdom, the government there decided to add a new twist to the definition of terrorism, which meant essentially democratic, peaceful protests now become a terrorist act. So, we now have a situation where being anti the notion of genocide is acceptable public opinion in Israel. And that is what you must express. You must deny the truth. Because by denying the truth, you are doing what the Israeli government wants you to do. The mobilization in support of Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian on our South African campuses is really commendable, and we thank South African universities for their support to her. We are also encouraged by the growing mobilization on college campuses across the world in support of the just cause for freedom and justice of the people of Palestine. Columbia University has been the locus of protest against America's support for the war in Gaza. Columbia University has a long history of protest on social justice issues in past decades, from the war in Vietnam to protests in support of the civil rights movement and the university campus movement against apartheid in South Africa in the 1980s. Columbia was the first American university to divest from apartheid South Africa. The student encampment at Columbia University, which began on April 17, has inspired students worldwide. Students had camped out in tents in protest over the war in Gaza and called for the university to divest itself from anything related to Israel. A massive crowd of faculty recently walked out in solidarity with students and with the movement for Palestine at Columbia University. Princeton University faculty and staff have also affirmed their solidarity with and support for the Columbia University and Barnard College students who are continuing their demand that the university divest from Israel's genocide in Gaza and ongoing occupation of the West Bank, of East Jerusalem, and other Palestinian land. Princeton has also called on Columbia University to reverse the suspension of the student groups in the university, the Columbia Students for Justice in Palestine, and Columbia Jewish Voices for Peace. Yale University, where my grandfather graduated, has become another flashpoint in the conflict between pro-Palestinian demonstrators and university administrators. Demonstrators were camped at the University Plaza, protesting Yale's refusal to divest from military weapons manufacturers, as they claim, the students, that it makes Yale complicit in Israel's genocide in Gaza. Students at the University of Minnesota were also recently arrested for demanding that their school divest funds from arms companies, including General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, and Honeywell. Students at New York University and MIT are the latest to have joined the pro-Palestinian movement. We are hopeful that this unprecedented activism by students in the United States will also spur greater activism among student movements here in South Africa and throughout the African continent. And if we start in South Africa, everyone will follow. We hope that this would then spur more vocal support from our university administrators, some of whom have remained silent. It is, dear colleagues, utterly unacceptable that Israel continues to disregard the rulings by the International Court of Justice, as well as UN resolutions, and continues its unrelenting bombardment of Gaza with impunity. Israel has simply ignored the ICJ's ruling, which granted South Africa's urgent request of 6 March 2024 for further provisional measures to prevent Israel from causing irreparable harm to the rights invoked by South Africa under the 1948 Genocide Convention in respect of the ongoing siege in Gaza. The court was unambiguous when it agreed with South Africa's assertion that the situation in Gaza had deteriorated significantly since the court's order of 26 January this year, as a result of Israel's failure and their failure in responsibility to comply with the court's ruling. The lack of accountability by Israel is increasingly clear. Those of you who are old enough to remember apartheid will recall that towards the end, as it was about to crumble, it became fierce in oppression. The seeds of the fall, and it needs us to be active in supporting it to ensure that those seeds flower. So don't rest. We concur as South Africa with the assertion of the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, Ms. Laleng Mofokeng, when she very correctly stated that Israel's war in Gaza has from the start been a war on the right to health and has obliterated the Palestinian territory's health system. We further agree with the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories, Ms. Francesca Albanese, when she recently highlighted that the continuation of Israel's impunity and exceptionalism is no longer viable, especially in light of the binding UN Security Council Resolution 2728, which called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. In this respect, we call on the international community to act to bring the perpetrators to justice and ensure accountability for the victims and their families. Unfortunately, due to my experiences of the letters and other actions, I can't tell you how to act because that is often used against me. But I can tell you to be activists. I won't tell you what to do, but be activists. The evidence that we have of the mass killings of civilians points to the perpetration of war crimes, crimes against humanity, which include murder and extermination, and genocide as defined in Article 6, 7, and 8 of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, as well as violations of the 1949 Geneva Conventions, specifically the 4th Geneva Convention, relative to the protection of civilian persons in a time of war, as well as customary international humanitarian law. International humanitarian law prohibits attacks on civilians and non-combatants, underlying the need to protect human life during times of war. I hope in this university, your lecturers encourage you to refer to international humanitarian law and international human rights law, and not to use phrases that are coined by unilateral actors of global rules-based system. The rules are international human rights law, international humanitarian law. There are no other rules. It's not football here. We're a world community, and we have conventions and protocols that we ratify in our parliaments, and it is those that set the rules. There's no other global rule-based world order. It's not. Conventions and protocols signed by us. laws we frame. So don't be bamboozled, because when someone is saying rules-based, they mean do what I want. They don't mean the laws we've all signed on to. So don't be fooled. And if your lecturers use that rules-based thing, just challenge them. It is clear from international law that states have to ensure that non-combatants are protected, even in times of war. As South Africa, we were really appalled and disgusted by the recent grim discovery of a mass grave containing the remains of over 200 Palestinian civilians at Nasser Hospital in Gaza. This followed the reported discovery of mass graves at Al-Shifa Hospital. These grim findings necessitate immediate and comprehensive investigations to ensure justice and accountability. The International Criminal Court has jurisdiction over the situation in Palestine, and we have previously called on the Office of the Prosecutor to urgently lead a thorough and impartial investigation into this matter, one that complies with international legal standards to establish the facts and bring those responsible to justice. It is the collective duty of the international community to ensure that atrocities of this nature are duly prosecuted in terms of the Rome Statute and the Geneva Conventions. If all of this were happening in Africa, they would have already issued warrants. It took 3 weeks to issue warrants on Putin, 7 months, nothing on Prime Minister Netanyahu and his ministers. We are equally concerned as South Africa with Israel's use of starvation as a weapon of war. Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has recently issued a new report, Manufacturing Famine, which concludes that Israel has been committing the crime of starvation under international law in the Gaza Strip. According to the report, the severe hunger that has developed over recent months in the Gaza Strip is the product of a deliberate and conscious Israeli policy. It has been openly declared by decision makers, including a member of the Israeli war cabinet, from the very beginning of the war, not in the middle, not later, right at the start. For months, Israel has pursued a policy of total blockade, complete destruction of the possibility of local food production through farming or fishing, and restrictions on the delivery of aid. The result of this policy is millions of starving people. Now imagine the NSFAS recipients if you were denied access to your allowance, totally denied, no food whatsoever. This is what's happening to the people of Palestine. And we are silent. We should all be going on hunger strike until they have food, even if it's once a week, something to show our solidarity. During Israel's blockade, Israel's years of blockade on Gaza, it has studied how much food Gaza's residents need to survive. Israel has drafted mathematical formulae and put together caloric tables for this purpose. As B'Tselem points out in its report, this means Israel entered the war with a vast amount of knowledge about the needs of Gaza's population and made a conscious choice to deny them, pushing hundreds of thousands of people into hunger and using starvation as a method of warfare. This is full dehumanization and nothing else. The dehumanization of Palestinians in Israeli eyes has accelerated in recent months. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, in March this year, 2.2 million people, almost 100% of the population in Gaza, were experiencing phase 3 level food insecurity or worse. 1.17 million were at phase 4, and nearly 500,000 people were experiencing the highest level of food insecurity, phase 5. In early April, Samantha Power, who heads the United States Agency for International Development, assessed that famine was already occurring in northern Gaza. The assessment was given during a hearing of the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee. This was the first time a U.S. official declared that famine was already present in Gaza after months of warnings that the hunger crisis was escalating. For many months, Israel has prevented the required scope of humanitarian relief, including food and medicines, from entering the Gaza Strip and particularly northern Gaza. The destruction that Israel sowed during the fighting has obliterated the ability to grow food, as I said earlier, and cause an almost entire reliance on outside aid. Which aid is controlled? By Israel. Israel is failing to meet its obligations in this regard by not allowing sufficient aid to enter the Strip and by failing to guarantee the safe arrival of the aid to its destination, even in areas it says are under its control. A concrete criminal prohibition on starvation is set out in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. Starvation of civilians is defined as a war crime under the ICC's jurisdiction, and they have to investigate and prosecute. Imagine 1 million signatures to the ICC saying we are waiting for you to prosecute. The Rome Statute definition of starvation is intentionally using starvation of civilians as a method of warfare by depriving them of objects indispensable to their survival, including willfully impeding relief supplies. So, in conclusion, in memory of Shireen Abu Akleh, we all continue to call on the ICC to prosecute these war crimes and to issue arrest warrants for those leaders in Israel who have ordered and presided over these crimes. The slowness to investigate and prosecute those responsible for these war crimes necessitates greater mobilization among the youth and civil society around the globe to ensure that justice for Palestinians is realized. As I have said, it is time for collective action by you and for us to champion the call for implementation of UN resolutions and rulings of the world's highest court. Your voice on this in social media, in protest, in petitions would be immeasurably important. We owe this responsiveness to the people of Palestine and to the memory of our dear departed Shireen Abu Akleh. I thank you for having allowed me this opportunity.
Do you think more nations should also show courage like South Africa did? Are you proud of South Africa's actions? Why did other nations that speak more of human rights fail to take this basic step? Let us know in the comment section if only African nations have taken the Palestine matter seriously. Do you want to watch more videos like this one? If yes, subscribe to our channel and press the bell icon next to it. We have decided to bring videos on something nobody talks about: African politics, economy, and increasing power. Thanks for watching, and until the next video, stay tuned.
Tell us what you think in the comment section. Like and share the video, and subscribe so that you don't miss any of our African videos. It's the best way to support us.
Welcome back, and that was Dr. Naledi Pandor speaking at the Shireen Abu Akla Conference, and that's going to conclude our program for today. We'll close out with the legendary Bob Marley from the album entitled Survival. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Look more zones. We'll fight.
what you wanted us to be. We are what we are. That's the way it's going to be. If you don't know, you can't educate us for no equal opportunity. Talking about my freedom, people freedom and liberty. Yeah, we've been cutting up the wine for much too long. Babylon.